When a lot of people choose books to take with us in summer vacation, we often think of big, fat, juicy novels that we can soak up with the sun. Maybe our idea of summer reading is a little narrow. We asked several book reviewers about their picks for summer readings. They came up with an eclectic list that includes everything from thrillers to memoirs to poetry. NPR's Lynn Neary has the details.
Laura Miller, book reviewer for Salon, is something of a traditionalist when it comes to summer reading. She likes a book that takes her far away from reality.
Because we can't always afford to go on vacations, or maybe our vacations are just to stay with our family, which isn't always as much of a getaway as we might want. And so I like the kind of novel that carries you off to some far-off and very different place.
This year, Miller has been carried off by the novel Under Heaven. It's set in an imaginary version of Tang Dynasty China. As the book begins, the hero, the son of a famous general, is given a fabulously extravagant gift by a princess,
which is 250 of the most perfect horses, and it puts him right in the middle of this incredibly complex and dangerous political situation.
Filled with palace intrigue, fueled by a famously beautiful and cunning concubine, Miller says Under Heaven combines the best of historical and fantasy fiction. For John Freeman, editor of the literary magazine Granta, a pure historical novel has caught his attention this year, Parrot and Olivier in America, inspired by Alexis de Tocqueville's visit to our young democracy in the 19th century. Olivier, based on de Tocqueville, is a French aristocrat. Parrot, his servant and companion, is the son of an itinerant printer. Freeman says the two are a mismatched pair.
And the story is told in their two voices. They go back and forth, narrating the book forward, and you get different impressions of America and American democracy in it. And it's just brilliant, the storytelling and the voices that he's created for these characters, the way they argue with each other. It's quite a bit of fun.
Freeman says he likes to read big novels like this on the beach, but later, sitting on a porch or settling down for the night, he wants something different. He'll pull out a more slender volume, essays, or even poetry.
I think poetry is like cocktail hour. It comes every day at a certain time, you know, and you look forward to it, at least I do, because it's, in some ways, it brings the sense of ritual back to language.
This summer, Freeman is taking U.S. Poet Laureate Kay Ryan's collection, The Best of It, on his travels. He says her poems aren't fussy or fancy, and they contain some hard truths.
But when you read that in this voice, this sort of well-carpentered, deeply intelligent, plain-spoken American voice, it's somehow soothing.
And with that, Freeman takes out his copy of the book and reads one of Ryan's poems.
There's a short poem called Emptiness, which I really love. It goes, "Emptiness cannot be compressed, nor can it fight abuse. Nor is there an endless west hosting elk, antelope, and the tough cayuse. This is true also of the mind. It can get used."
But if poetry seems an odd choice for summer reading to some, how about a book by the famously acerbic author Christopher Hitchens?
You don't like a good sort of beach blanket indictment of Henry Kissinger?
Troy Patterson, who reviews for Slate, says in his memoir, Hitch 22, Christopher Hitchens is more chatty than catty, as if he were relaxing in an armchair, not standing at a lectern.
This feels less like what we've come to think of as a memoir than just sort of a great raconteur telling stories about his own life.
Patterson says some of the best stories are about Hitchens' friendships with well-known writers like Salman Rushdie and Martin Amis, story Hitchens talked about on this program. And as a companion to this book, Patterson recommends Amis's new novel, The Pregnant Widow, a coming-of-age story set in the 1970s about a character named Keith Nearing.
He's British. She's 20. He's spending the summer in Italy with his girlfriend, Lily, and her friend, Scheherazade. And this will prove to be an erotically decisive summer for Keith.
Patterson, who says he's more of a hammock reader than a beach reader, believes Amis is the best prose stylist in the English language today. So he loves the extra time that summer gives him to linger over the words. But if you prefer the kind of book that makes your pulse race, then you may have noticed a genre that's missing from this list, a genre that Laura Miller says is a must on any summer reading list.
You have to have your international thriller where the people travel to exotic places. This is Michael Gruber's The Good Son, which is that rare thriller that when you read it, you don't sort of feel like you just ate like an entire bag of potato chips.
The Good Son, says Miller, is a smart thriller about a U.S. Special Forces soldier raised in Pakistan whose mother gets kidnapped in Afghanistan. It has lots of action and suspense, but is also a thought-provoking look at the differences between modern Western culture and a tribal way of life. Miller says Gruber is one of the best thriller writers around.
Anyone who's ever read a Michael Gruber novel will sort of buttonhole you and pull you aside and say, you have to read this guy. You have to read him. He's so great because he's such a wonderful writer and he's such a great plotter. And those two things are so rarely found.
So it doesn't really matter if you choose a big, fat, juicy novel or a slim volume of poetry, a memoir or a thriller. The point is, it's summer, a great excuse to read whenever and whatever you want. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
And you can read excerpts from all these critics' picks on our website. Search for the Summer Books Package, where you'll find a lot more recommendations for everything from cookbooks to crime fiction. Go to npr.org/summerbooks.
The British journalist William Dalrymple has spent decades reporting from India, and he never seems to run out of stories to tell.
People in America think of India as a country. In reality, it's much more a continent. It contains, like America does, every kind of climate from the high Himalayas through the deserts of Rajasthan down to the tropical south. And within that geographical area, you have this incredible spread of different religious systems, many of which go back to the beginning of man's thought about God.
Those religious systems are the focus of William Dalrymple's latest book. It's called Nine Lives. The nine lives in question are deeply religious people in South Asia. They are Hindus, Buddhists, Sufi Muslims, and more. They include monks and dancers and a man described as a feeder of skulls. Even in the context of India, they take their devotion to the limit. And the incredible variety of belief is what drew Dalrymple to talk with them.
People again talk of Hinduism as if it's a single faith. Hinduism is a vast network of different religious systems and different religious practices.
Now, in one of the early profiles, you meet a woman who is a Jain nun. Who are the Jains?
The Jains are, in a sense, the sister religion of Buddhism. A little bit older. This is the very sophisticated urban world of about 500 BC in the Ganges Basin, at the point when India was way ahead of most parts of the world, except a few cities around the Mediterranean. And this was one of the first great urban cultures of the world. The Jains, while having the same ideas as the Buddhists about wanting to keep away from the pleasures of the flesh and withdraw from the world and find yourself within, had a far more severe route to that. To give just two examples, Buddhist monks shave their heads. The Jains pluck out their hairs one by one in a ceremony that's deliberately painful. Likewise, Buddhist monks can beg, but Jain monks have to just signal hunger by arching their right hand over their shoulder. Beyond that, they're not allowed to ask for food, and they're never allowed to touch money of any sort.
But you meet a Jain nun who's clad in white, and there is a quote that strikes me, because this woman recounts to you that she's supposed to renounce all worldly pleasures, all attachments to anything, but she went and, well, she had a friend. She had a companion.
This was the one attachment that she had, and this was, you know, completely according to the Jain faith. Nuns are not, for obvious reasons of personal danger, are not meant to wander around alone. But what my nun, Prasannamata Mataji, had found was that while she'd given up all her worldly wealth, while she'd given up her family, that was wandering the earth, treading as lightly as possible on the earth. They sweep the ground in front of them to make sure they don't step on ants, and they won't step on puddles in case there's some life form that they will hurt inside the puddles. Despite all those efforts that she was making, she did have this one attachment, which was her close friend, the nun who she walked with for 20 years. And when that nun got ill and found that she was dying slowly, she undertook what is for Jains the final stage of Jain asceticism, which, having given up all your goods and everything, you then start to give up food. And it's a process which they do over 2 to 3 years in a very set way that they've been doing for centuries. And, of course, they die. And this is, for them, they say, this is not suicide. This is merely giving up one set of clothes to go on into the next life. Because, like the Buddhists, they believe in reincarnation.
There are so many things that are striking about that life and that way of life, point of view that you describe. And yet, I'm leading up to something that struck me even more. You speak to this woman who became attached to her companion on the roads and, of course, was deeply saddened when her companion, 20 years... And not only was she sad, she was disappointed in herself to be sad. She shouldn't have ever been that close to anybody at all.
Well, in both Buddhism and in Jainism, a lack of attachment also means a detachment. And to be truly detached, you can't love. You can't form close friendships with people. And she realized that she had not followed, in her view, the dictates of her faith because she loved her companion.
And she says, I was punished for that. I formed not just an attachment, but a strong attachment, and that left an opening for suffering. And that's the quote that struck me, because we have gone as far, I think, as you could imagine from the character in the American movie or the American country song who is encouraged to open themselves up and take a chance and take a risk on embracing the world. And this is someone going for the exact opposite
ideal. This was really the point of doing this book, because today we live with this illusion that we know the world. The reality, of course, is, and this became very clear after 9/11, that there's huge parts of the world which we know absolutely nothing about, particularly in areas of religion and philosophy. And the veneer of globalization is such a deceptive thing. And the idea that really inspired me with this book was to... India is, you know, these days is a very fast-developing place. You go to India, the economy is going to be overtaking the US by 2050. There are, outside my where I live in Delhi, there are now, you know, the headquarters of Google Asia, mm-hmm. back office processing units. It's developing incredibly fast. There are coffee places like Starbucks. All over the world, you have this veneer of globalization. And yet, you've only got to rub away that surface veneer. And you find huge, vast differences still in the world. And that, to me, is the job of the travel writer today.
I realize that you went looking among these different religions for professional reasons. You wanted to explain a subcontinent in a different way. But because you were spending time with so many people who were having such deeply intense personal experiences, I wonder if you were seeking anything yourself.
First of all, to make it clear, this was emphatically not a book about my religious search. I've tried as objectively as possible really to tell the stories of 9 people and keep myself out of it. But there's no question that over the 25 years I've been there, India and the religions of India have completely altered the way I look at the world. And it's something you don't notice as it happens because it's a slow drip process. But I went to India I have an almost fundamentalist Catholic background. And I went to a monastic school, was brought up by Benedictine monks, had a wonderful education at a school called Amberforth. But India changes everything. And I think the great lesson of India is pluralism, that it makes it very difficult to believe in only your own faith, that the faith you happen to have been born into is the only possible way of reaching God. The Indian idea that there are many ways up the mountain, I think, is a very powerful one.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
William Dalrymple, author of 9 Lives in Search of the Sacred in Modern India.
The story of the ill-fated Donner Party continues to fascinate us because it's the American westward ho nightmare writ large. But for writer Gabrielle Burton, other lessons generated by the expedition take precedence over the familiar lurid accounts of cannibalism. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a rave review for Burton's 2 new books about the Donner Party.
Summer gives me the chance to go off-road in my reading, to investigate books by lesser-known authors that have piqued my curiosity. Lots of times these detours turn into dead ends. But once in a while, the road less traveled leads to the literary equivalent of El Dorado, the lost city of gold. That's where I've been happily ensconced for the past week or so, thanks to Gabrielle Burton. Burton is a writer closing in on 70, whose near-lifelong obsession with Tamsin Donner, the wife of the leader of the notorious Donner Party, has produced 2 recent books, one a very good novel, the other, an extraordinary must-read memoir. The known facts of Tamsin Donner's life are these. She was born in 1801 in Massachusetts, and as a young woman, traveled by herself to teaching posts in Maine and North Carolina. After the death of her first husband and son, Tamsin went on to marry George Donner, an older widower. In the spring of 1846, when Tamsin was 44, she set off with George, their five daughters, aged 13 to 3, and some 80 other men, women, and children on the California-Oregon Trail bound for San Francisco Bay. As everybody knows, the Donner Party was trapped in the Sierra Nevada by freak early snows and resorted to cannibalism to survive. When rescuers arrived, Tamsin sent off her daughters, while she made the fatal decision to stay behind with her dying husband. Tamsin's body and the journal she kept throughout the trip were never found. According to eyewitnesses, the three littlest Donner girls spent weeks at Sutter's Fort in present-day Sacramento, their eyes on the mountains, crying, "If Mother would only come." Gabrielle Burton is also the mother of five daughters. She'd been drawn to Tamsin Donner not just because of that coincidence, but also because, she says, Tamsin always seemed restless, seemed to want more. As an overwhelmed young mother in the late 1960s, Burton knew firsthand about the illicit desire for more. One of the things she desired was to become a writer, and on and off over the decades, Burton worked on a novel about Tamsin Donner. All those years of research and meditation have given the novel Burton has finally published a sense of authority. Its title, Impatient with Desire, is taken from a phrase in one of Tamsin's 17 extant letters. The novel is imagined as Tamsin's lost journal, and in particular the sections that depict Tamsin and the dying George alone in the vast vacancy of the deserted campsite are haunting. It's Gabrielle Burton's own fault, however, that I'm not spending more time talking about her fine novel, because last year she published an unusual memoir called Searching for Tamsin Donner. You'll probably have to search a bit yourself for this book, since it was put out by the University of Nebraska Press as part of their American Lives series. But it is so worth the effort. Burton writes about a shoestring budget trip she took in 1977, along with her husband and five daughters, all crammed into the family station wagon. Already deep into Donner research, Burton wanted to retrace the party's route from Illinois to California. Originally, Burton, newly fired up by the women's liberation movement, had planned to make the pilgrimage alone on a cherry red motorcycle. But being a small woman, she couldn't control the heavy bike. And so begins a feminist, family, on-the-road saga, the likes of which I've never read before. The Burton family stops at lonely pioneer graves off highways and swims in the Great Salt Lake, and all the while, fledgling writer Gabrielle Burton is making daily calculations about how to fulfill her responsibilities as a wife and mother without, like Tamsin Donner, discovering all too late that her duty had cost her her life. As Burton wisely says, talking about emotional cannibalism, the nicest husbands and children will eat you up alive if you offer yourself on the plate, and they'll ask for seconds. Both Madonna of the Trail, Tamsin Donner, and feminist mother Gabrielle Burton turned out to be pioneers, carving new roads for women to travel. Both their stories are absolutely unforgettable.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed two books by Gabrielle Burton, Searching for Tamsin Donner and Impatient with Desire. To see Maureen's top crime picks for summer, go to the summer book section of npr.org.